There's a lot of talk in the last several years about how meditative disciplines such as mindfulness meditation, etc., help free us from the shackles of depression and anxiety. Huh? These two are often joined at the hip. For the sake of simplicity, I'll use the word depression here to include both depression and its friends, such as anxiety, dark thoughts, poor sleep, nausea, loss of appetite altogether. Even the most cosmetic forms of contemplative practice can be an enormous help in treating and relieving symptoms of depression. And there's an impressive body of scientific research to back this up. That the practice of contemplation can be a natural, lasting treatment for depression, either chronic or acute, and its significant other, anxiety. As the author of The Cloud of Unknowing says, the work of contemplation will have a favorable effect on the body as well as the soul of anyone who practices it. And this is all wonderful news. However, what if we are seasoned contemplatives and continue to meet depression, even serious depression? Not only does our depression depression come and go for varying lengths of time, but it can come and refuse to budge. Next thing, we know depression and its friends have claimed squatter's rights in our lives. And these include highly habituated thought patterns, such as harsh judgments against ourselves, self-loathing, not matching up to perceived expectations. The communion of inner solitude becomes suffocating isolation. Feelings of being cut off. Having difficulty receiving the love of others, including God's. Self-medicating. Dark thoughts of all sorts. But all this literature that says meditation or the practice of contemplation makes it go away can make us feel like pious frauds, that we flunked contemplation. Because the literature says it's supposed to pry loose depression's grip. And what I would like to talk about today is what if it doesn't? And how a depression that doesn't budge can become a ministry of intercession for those who have completely lost their way. More than feeling contemplative flunkies, we're still aware that there's still a lot of social stigma that it continues to attach, because it's called mental illness. It would be far better for us to say with conviction that simply depression is a factor or a part of my inner weather. But instead we purchase this stigma and consume it like some forbidden fruit and feel we need to hide. Hiding didn't work for Adam and Eve, and it will not work for us. It only adds weight to what is already burdensome. The author of The Cloud of Unknowing, in another work called The Letter of Private Direction, or The Letter of Privy Council, says, "Do not be dismayed by any disquieting fear, though the fiend should come, as indeed it will, bringing sudden panic, banging and beating on the walls of our house." He knew panic, anxiety. While we clearly prefer to be relieved of this burden, sometimes it simply doesn't happen. And if it seems that depression is a frequent pattern of our inner weather, it is important for us to get to know our depression more important than getting rid of it, if it happens to be there. The contemplative skill needed is the same as it is for every other situation. Allow it to be present if it happens to be present. And knowing directly, intimately, the unique contours of depression that won't go away can let in the slightest bit of fresh air, because it leads to self-knowledge. And that little shift shifts us from being victim to witness. Even if depression does not loosen its grip, the skills of self-knowledge and inner vigilance are life-giving. Everyone's depression is different. We all have different personal histories, genetic packages, life histories. We're all the same, really, in radically unique ways. For some people's depression, it's a matter of genetics. We're prone to depression because the brain does not produce sufficient quantities of serotonin, norepinephrines, dopamines, GABA, and so on. And perhaps we've struggled with depression on and off most of our lives. Or perhaps somewhere in our journey, a traumatic event has flicked on the genetic switch, and no one knows how to flick it back off. Others self-medicate themselves onto the alcohol spectrum in an attempt to treat life pain. In this case, depression, anxiety. The problem here is that eventually alcohol over a certain period of time will increase the anxiety and depression it once promised it might calm. And, as I said, it's worsened by the social stigma, which is which ends up being reinforced by medical professionals who want to help us. They tell us we have a disorder. And many even read us something from the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's the ultimate authority and Bible in the psychiatric and legal professions. In the medical world, however, and doctors don't tell you this because they just speak jargon at us, that a disorder is a technical term in the medical world, which simply means they don't know where it comes from and how to heal it. One of the foremost authorities in depression, a professor at Harvard University, walked into the lecture hall when the medical students were going to learn about depression, and he said, "I am reputed to know all there is about depression, and all I have to tell you is we don't know where it comes from, how to treat it, and how to make it go away." There's a whole lot of educated guesswork. And for some people, pharmaceutical assistance helps. But for some, it doesn't. But it doesn't help if we're already struggling with stigma, for a doctor to say, "You have a disorder," because we already feel disordered. So unwittingly, medical professionals can even add to the problem. In a challenging poem by the poet Franz Wright called Pediatric Suicide, he objects strongly to being defined by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. As he resists the tendency to allow himself to be labeled by such terms as disorder. And he writes in this poem, "Being who you are is not a disorder. Being unloved is not a psychiatric disorder. I can't find being born in a diagnostic manual." Now, people who have depression know that there remains some hidden essential something that can't be shoehorned in the narrow shoes of a definition. A journal entry by a man named Wendell Miles in a memoir written by his older sister, Margaret, the theologian Margaret Miles, writes, "Don't minimize my life, people. Thoughts, desires for knowledge, inner peace. My whole life has been in these pursuits. Some genetics are probably my worst enemy, some environmental factors, but please don't put me in a category." Among the most challenging aspects of the struggle with depression that won't budge is struggling itself. Struggling with depression is like thrashing in quicksand. We sink quickly. If depression has set up house in our home, then in addition to the interior skills of self-knowledge, depression itself simply becomes our contemplative practice. It becomes the cushion we sit on. And this itself creates a changed relationship with depression. And so my purpose here is to suggest that the contemplative who has depression as a regular, uninvited guest can play a vitally important, necessary role for others who have the same struggle but do not have this practice of contemplation that lends itself to self-knowledge. And truly can end up playing an intercessory role for others who have the same struggle but have none of the inner skills of a contemplative discipline. And a profound inner awakening can occur within depression without its necessary departure. But the awakening does not necessarily make it go away. So I am talking about depression that has set up squatters' rights. And how a changed relationship with it, that it is a part of our contemplative practice, can end up establishing an intercessory solidarity with others who struggle. Just like any affliction, depression can become a place of intercession as we become a bridge for those who have no bridge. For some reason, we think that in order to move forward, there must be so much light that we see the entire road of our life out in front of us, lit up for miles and miles ahead. This never happens in life, except fantasies. Thankfully, it's not necessary to see so far ahead into the future. In fact, Yoda says, don't do it. The future, very murky it is. But just like driving a car along the road at night. The headlights of the car light up just enough of the road to see, no more. But as we're moving, more road is illumined. Not all of it, but always just enough. This light, little though it is the light that shines in darkness, a light that darkness doesn't overpower. Even if it's just whatever stretch of road that our car lights up. Yes, it is darkness, but paradoxically, a darkness all of light. The psalmist sings the same paradox. Darkness is not dark to you, and night shines as the day. Darkness and light are but one. Depression can aid, deepen, establish a contemplative practice, because depression can help us stay anchored in the present moment. Because often enough, people who struggle with depression have to whittle the whole day, an entire day, down into the manageable bits. Some say, I just need to make it to noon. Others, 15 minutes. But it roots us closer into the present moment. Because you see, hopes for future and so forth, the curtains are closed. And so many people who struggle with depression know about the vital importance of staying right now. Because right now, I might just about make it. And I'll deal with 10 minutes from now when that comes. I'd like to recount a story of somebody with her struggle with depression and how depression became a locus of intercession and solidarity with those who didn't have her contemplative discipline insight. I call her Millicent. She says, I long to escape from the paralysis of the day's mental fog and jump into the arms of sleep. Yet every night I dread climbing into bed. Despite the medication I'm on, the friendship that sleep promises always betrays me, just as every friend I remember having in school departed with no goodbye, because her father was suddenly transferred. The friend changed schools. There was always some reason. At night, I'm more vulnerable to to the vultures that see my mind as if not carrion, then certainly easy prey. I remembered a line from the Bible. You shall not fear the terrors of the night, nor the arrows that fly by day. I'm a Christian, and I'm inspired by the way Jesus treated those on the margins. It's obvious in the New Testament that, in the eyes of Jesus, those who don't count, count. Both as a woman and as someone who feels very much on the margins of life, I feel I matter to Jesus, who says he is the way, the truth, the life. And I long to be looked at by Jesus. I can't remember the last time I slept soundly for more than a few hours at a time. About the only time when a depression loosens its vice is when I get out of bed in the morning and shower. I remember years ago, I learned Tai Chi. One of our warm-up exercises had us all vigorously patting up and down the sides of our legs and arms. And I would feel wide awake and feel the vital energy rising in my body. And I noticed other people's faces suddenly had rosy color. And the exercise was called raising the chi. I don't do Tai Chi anymore. But it left me too much with myself, my thoughts, which I simply could not bear at that time. But I remember this exercise every time I shower, though certainly less vigorous. The movements are practically the same when showering. I wear exfoliating gloves, and when I apply shower gel, I finish washing up by patting up and down my arms and legs, just like I did in Tai Chi, and I feel invigorated. The energy of the chi rises. My spirits do lift for a while, and I say to myself, the depression is lifting, which it is. But only for 20 minutes or so. But in this brief period of time, I breathe in and out air. And I feel a sense of being alive. I leave the house and join friends for morning coffee and scones. They'll all have been up since dawn, exercising, kickboxing, lifting weights, spinning. The only weight I lift is the weight of my body out of the bed. As I try to get out of the bed, I should say, my friends have coffee. I have hot water with lemon or perhaps chamomile or peppermint tea. A cup of coffee would set off the anxiety 2 hours before the anxiety sets itself off. Inevitably, a friend will ask me, "How did you sleep?" I respond, "Well, like a baby." This is just to dodge the question. If I answered the question truthfully, "How do you sleep?" I'd respond, "I slept like a baby. I wake up every 2 hours crying." It's a fairly well-known joke she's recounting. But Millicent had debilitating depression on and off for decades. She's now in her mid-50s. She didn't know what the word depression meant, much less that it applied to her, until she went off to college and learned about depression in a psychology class. And once when she was home for Christmas break, she told her parents, "I think I might have serious depression." Her parents replied that depression was a form of self-indulgence. "It would go away if I spent more time being grateful for the things I had that less fortunate people didn't have." Millicent said to herself, "I am grateful, but I still have depression." She never discussed it again with her parents. And they forgot that the conversation, such as it was, ever took place. She says, "When I was young, my father had to drop me off at school early twice a week so that he could get to a meeting. It was 30 years before I discovered that he was going to AA meetings. The school doors weren't open at this hour. The only place for me to go was in the church. There were always a few other students in there too who needed to be dropped off early. And I loved going in there at that hour. The nuns were still chanting Lauds, morning prayer. I had never heard or seen anything like it. Their voices were lilting, and their harmonies revealed a depth dimension. Life. As though what we can perceive with our senses was only scratching the surface. It was so calming. I never wanted it to end." And Millicent did experience moments of relief, no matter how brief. The nuns chanting, and the hand cross given to her by her grandmother. A hand cross is, if you know what they are, they're small, carved out of wood, and you can hold them in your hand, like so. And she held and kept this cross given to her by her grandmother. And Millicent said she also liked to paint her toenails. "I was balled up in the very large chair in my room getting ready to paint my toenails. All balled up, painting my nails introduced me to a different dimension of my mind that was free of all the incessant noise in my head. I don't know if it was the centeredness I felt due to the position of my body or to the self-forgetfulness that happens accidentally when you become completely attentive. Apparently you have to pay close attention when you're painting your toenails. I don't know much about it. But see, the attentiveness, a contemplative skill. The attentiveness needed to apply the tip of the brush to each toenail. There suddenly opened up within me and around me a quiet center that was untouched by the noise of my chaos. A circle, and there was a circle of sunlight around my feet. A patch of light with enough space to live in, if only I could live in it. It didn't last long, but its mark was permanent. In the midst of depression, I could see there's a spacious corner of light. And this realization marked a turning point in her life. depression is present. Sleep is still an ordeal. But Millicent knows, and Millicent knows all too well the black hours of endless nights. But there is something that underlines Millicent's depression. This practice of attentiveness by something as domestic as planting, painting toenails. In a memoir of his own descent into depression, the American author William Styron writes, "Depression is a disorder of mood. And it becomes crippling and incomprehensible to those who do not know it." And he recounts in his book something incomprehensible to those who have not themselves been driven on this dimly lit road. But Millicent teaches us that her descent into depression does not have the final word on a life rich with meaning. And her discovery of inner silence, in this blotch of sunlight around her feet, bestowed a certain meaning and purpose. As she put it, "In these small patches, I discovered that the world is a place where I belong. And I'm welcome by the love of God that comes to us in Christ Jesus." I can't believe what I'm about to say, but clearly depression can be a better teacher than joy. I say this simply because I tend to cling to joy. I say this simply, it's more difficult to cling to depression. And pushing it away is not an option for me. If only depression would go away. Nevertheless, depression does not have to go away for us to realize, she says, this radiant center. In my case, the realization brought with it a certain call to serve others. When I sit on my prayer bench, I sit for all those people who have lost their way in the waters of depression. I sit in solidarity with them. And this has transformed my relationship with depression. Depression has become my prayer bench and my place of outreach to others just by my remaining still. Here I sit in solidarity with all beings, but especially with all those people who are lost in despair, whether they know it, whether they know that I am there for them or not. As the author of The Cloud of Unknowing says, sitting, the practice of contemplation, helps the entire world in ways we do not know. When we sit in silent contemplation, in the midst of whatever affliction, whatever it may be, an affliction that doesn't happen to go away, we make it our conscious intention to sit in solidarity with all who suffer affliction, but do not have the insight and the commitment of faith that has come from my simple practice to realize that our own pain is personal, but not private to us, is deeply liberating. As we sit on our chair, prayer cushion, our prayer bench, or simply lie in bed because at the moment we can't manage much else, we are free, even in the midst of depression that won't budge, to become a gathering place for all who suffer in this life. We become a bridge for all those who have no bridge. This is how the practice of contemplation as a vehicle of grace works within us, even in our most desperate circumstances, when we honestly don't know how we can keep going on. And it reaches out. Through our willingness, our consent to sit in stillness. And our depression becomes a ministry of outreach and solidarity to the afflicted. And we don't do this to get rid of our affliction. We do this because silence is another name for compassion. So in our afflictions, whatever they be, the ones that don't go away for very long, if met in the right way, normally we sit in order to acquire something, acquire a sense of spiritual progress, or to make what we don't like about our lives go away. That's enough to get us started. But insofar as we're responsive to the mysterious ways in which God works in life, even in affliction and dereliction, and please remember, especially in John's Gospel, the afflicted one, the mocked one, the degraded one, the crucified one, that death brings on the rending of the temple veil that hid the Holy of Holies, the great unspeaking absence, the great speaking absence of God. The death of Jesus is the manifestation of God. This is the hidden potential in all affliction. In this case, considering depression. If worked into something as soul sifting as the practice of contemplation. Our relationship with it changes, and we sit on the cushion, the prayer bench, our chair of practice, which happens to be at that moment our affliction. Then we become vehicles, servants of grace, and a connecting point of intercession. We become a bridge for all those who have no bridge. Contemplation is not for sissies, or those who are looking for spiritual fluffies. There's nothing more soul sifting than our practice, and nothing which humbles us to the point where what we can manage is just to be. And this is the role of the suffering servant, to be a bridge for those who have no bridge. So I leave you with this question. What do you do with your pain? What do you do with your affliction that won't happen to go away, having exhausted means, appropriate means to deal with it medically, psychotherapeutically? Realize that it is a divine invitation for those things that we would rather not face, yet are fixed, or pour us to grace and contribute to the spiritual economy of this world in ways we know not, for we walk by faith, as Paul says, and not by sight. And become bridges for those who have no bridge. Often when I give various talks like this on depression like this, and it is a chapter in that book, I've read part of it, there are other people, nobody wants to ask a question but just be remain silent. But we have some time. And so, if any questions, yes.
In your book, you write, "We don't normally get rid of dryness so much as we stop demanding that it goes away. Spiritual aridity is the natural terrain of stillness." Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, that is what the dark night of the sense amounts to. Dryness, aridity. And that is one of the early trials of people who are dedicated to prayer, is that the juice dries up. There's aridity. We're actually taken deeper when we think we've gone astray. And many people then, because of the spirituality marketplace, go on to something else that promises, you know, brandy fumes of enlightenment. But if that's an authentic path, it'll lead right back there. But yes, that follows directly on what was asked about the dark nights. And that's the first night of the three, the senses. And that separates the sheep from the goats. And because what's in it for me? As an isolated, separate self. And this is going to be the great challenge as our culture gets more and more corporatized, commodified, is something that I pursue. It needs to deliver what I think it should in the terms I think it should. And how on earth do we know? Yes, thank you for reminding us of the welcoming prayer is just, however it's described, is allowing, consciously allowing whatever is to be present. Huh? The most powerful searing one is by the Sufi poet Rumi. It's just, if you don't know it, I'd be happy to send it in and have it sent out. But you might well know it. I don't have it memorized, but it is just a radical, whatever is happening to me, this is the vehicle, two-way vehicle of God to me and me out. Huh? Yeah, thank you, yes. And the prayer by the famous ethicist Reinhold Niebuhr, it's later become called the Serenity Prayer. That's worked its way into many of the 12 step traditions, but it was by a very well known theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr. Lord, help me to accept the things I cannot change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And these are things that some people use, like the welcoming prayer or something like that, to call to mind as they begin their practice, their sitting in silence, you know, to help gather and focus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. By way of closing, I'd like to thank each of you for the generosity of your presence, the generosity of your practice, which held us all in a silence that many of you mentioned as supportive in resurrecting hope that we may return home to face burdens and circumstances that are difficult for returning home to integrate what we may have been given here. And personally, I would like to thank you for welcoming me into your presence. Bow your heads and pray for God's blessing. May the peace of Christ, which is beyond all human understanding, be alive in your hearts and be your every strength and consolation. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.